Maybe you live in a neighborhood that has gentrified. What was once a scruffy place of time-worn buildings and lower rents has become slicker and smoother and more expensive, with brand-name stores instead of locally owned bodegas. It's not real estate or the physical world we'll talk about at this hour, not much anyway. Instead, we'll focus on the places we live and hang out online. Those too have changed over the decades. Jessa Lingle documents the changes and the forces that brought them about in the book, The Gentrification of the Internet: How to Reclaim Our Digital Freedom. Jessa Lingle is an associate professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. She is an activist too, working with the Creative Resistance Collective and the Workers' Solidarity Network on issues like gentrification. Jessa Lingle, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I noticed that some of the activism is directed at your employer. What is pentrification?
Pentrification is a pretty clever name the local West Philadelphia residents have come up with to talk about gentrification in a neighborhood in Philadelphia called University City. So it's Penn and also the local university, Drexel. And residents have often felt that these pretty wealthy private schools have come in and often displaced longtime residents. Philadelphia as a whole is a fairly poor city. It's also a majority Black city. And so the issue of richer universities coming in often means displacing people who usually get displaced, which are poor folks and people of color.
So I guess we should back up and talk about the definition of gentrification that you work with, because it's fairly important to at least understand what the baseline is here.
Yeah, gentrification is a loaded term, so it's good to try and be specific about it. But for the most part, with something that, you know, researchers have studied since the 1970s, and it's an urban phenomenon where richer groups of folks move in, and it's both residences and businesses, and over time, they tend to push out folks who have lived there a lot longer. And as a result, you see this transformation of the neighborhood where longstanding social ties get broken, longstanding businesses have to close up shop, and in its place, people with more money, more resources, and they sort of remake the neighborhood in their own image. And one of the real ironies is that a lot of folks move into a neighborhood because they like the character and they like the community. But if they, you know, don't pay attention to the local community ties, then what happens is they wind up transforming the community into something that was quirky or creative or very authentic, and transforming it into something a lot more generic and cookie cutter.
It's kind of something similar to what happens in tourist towns, isn't it, where things are so quirky and delightful that people come in and change the nature of what made it quirky and delightful.
Absolutely. And what you really see is that it's a process that unfolds over time. And so you sort of watch this transformation happen. And as I was saying earlier about what's happening in West Philadelphia, is that it's a problem when the same folks who get pushed out or displaced are the people who usually get pushed out and displaced, which are people with fewer resources.
Now, you point out, too, that when gentrification happens in physical spaces, it's not just big houses taking up spaces that were once multifamily housing, but empty spaces as well. Is there a lot of speculation in areas that are gentrifying?
Absolutely. So the cities where this is happening a lot are cities like Manhattan, but also Vancouver, Toronto. In some cases, 30% of the real estate, recent real estate is not occupied. It's simply an investment. So it's usually a foreign investment where people are holding on to property like they would hold on to stocks or bonds or paintings, which is terrible for people who actually live in that neighborhood, live in that community, because they can't continue to live there. They can't compete with those high prices. They're not able to afford it. But even if they could, there's not actually someone living there. It's just an empty apartment, an empty house. So I think one thing to keep in mind, though, is the narrative of gentrification that you often have is that it's the individual decisions of one or two homeowners making a choice about where they want to live, but policies are always at the root. So it's not actually an individual consumer issue. It's really more of a policy-level issue. Local lawmakers deciding we're going to have policies that encourage things like foreign investment and property.
That's interesting. So you end up with vacant spaces in cities that often have problems with homelessness, too, I would think.
Problems with homelessness, problems with affordable housing. I mean, if you think about Vancouver, they have incredibly expensive housing. The irony there is you have all these empty apartments. And, you know, those apartments aren't apartments that are in the same, you know, bracket of folks who are most in need of housing. But there is still that sharp contrast between having very expensive housing that nobody lives in while there's such a deep, deep need for affordable housing. And when there's a deep need for affordable housing, then you're always going to see an increase in homelessness.
Okay, so before we get to a break here, I want to at least raise the issue of how is this happening on the internet then? I mean, we're not talking a physical space here.
We're not talking physical space, but we are talking about changes in culture and changes in the ability to build a community online. So, and the ability for a community to thrive online is increasingly being commodified and being privatized. And those same forces of commodifying space, privatizing space are in a lot of ways what's driving gentrification. And it's also driving our ability to express ourselves, to build community and online platforms.
So Jessa, let's talk about the kinds of things that we find in gentrification in the physical world that we're also finding on the internet. What are some of the major components of that?
Gentrification in a few key ways. One has to do with displacement, which is people who have longstanding ties to a community getting pushed out. And online, you can sort of see that as these major players like Facebook and Google move in, smaller platforms get pushed out. So it's easy to think now that the internet has always basically been, you know, you hear social media and you think Facebook, but in the early days of the internet, there were actually all of these very quirky, very niche platforms that were meant to serve folks with their own particular interests. So some of those were countercultural groups interested in things like body modification. Other folks just, you know, interested in Grateful Dead music, interested in Star Trek, and they would have their own platforms and own community groups. And as these larger companies have moved in, those smaller platforms have been displaced, which is the process that's very familiar to folks who live in a gentrifying neighborhood. You also see the commodification, which is a process of new businesses sprouting up and displacing longstanding businesses that usually did a better job of serving folks at the community level. So you might think of Walmart or even a dollar store, Family Dollar, coming in and making it impossible for a smaller business to thrive, like a bodega or a community-owned grocery store, or just your average mom-and-pop shop, which, again, is super familiar to folks who live in gentrifying neighborhoods. And online, I don't want to make it sound like there was ever this glory day of the internet where everything was about, you know, peace, love, and community, and no one was trying to make a buck, but this prioritization has really moved away in the tech industry. From sort of creative, you know, tech nerdiness to a much more privatized and corporate version of the city, of the internet. And then the final issue is around diversity and which voices and which stories get told. So again, the early days of the internet were certainly not, you know, a haven of diversity, but it was a lot easier in many ways to represent diverse viewpoints or to have countercultural groups or subcultural groups create spaces for themselves. And you see a much more, a monotonous sense of culture, a monotonous sense of community on Facebook because they're catering to the lowest common denominator. They're catering to the most general population, not to the folks on the margins. And so that same process of quirkiness or niche cultural identity that we were talking about in urban spaces, which initially draws a lot of people to the neighborhoods and eventually gets pushed out. And then you see instead these chain stores or stores that are catering to new clientele rather than the older, longstanding clientele.
So the example that you gave about the body modification group, and we'll talk more about that because there are some examples to be had from the early days of the internet, rather than have their own space now, they're a group on Facebook or something. And so they're basically giving all their stuff to Facebook the way everybody else does.
And you might ask, well, what's the problem? If people can still meet online, does it really matter if they're meeting on their own platform or on Facebook? And I have a couple responses to that. One is now you're playing by Facebook's rules. So, you know, Facebook, if anything is presents as a, you know, female presenting nipple, it will get, you know, shut down on Facebook. Male presenting nipples are okay. So what do you do if you have piercings that you want to show on your platform? Well, on older platforms, like, for example, BME, Body Modification Easing, which predates Facebook by a decade, obviously they had much more liberal views on what self-expression looked like because they wanted to show off things like body modification. So you're on this, you're still on the internet on Facebook. You're still able to connect with folks, but the rules are being set by, you know, a huge company that doesn't really do a very good job of meeting needs at the margins, instead of an older platform where you could set your own rules. So that sort of loss of freedom and loss of self-expression, that's really what's at stake in these platforms that are gentrifying.
So what happened to Body Modification Easing, BME?
Well, it kind of, I believe it is still technically online, but its membership declined from a peak of around 10,000 folks, and then now it's basically reduced to a couple, actually two competing Facebook groups online of BME folks. So the vibrant discussions that used to be there, the, you know, trade of photos, the sense of community that sprung up on that platform, now all that has migrated to Facebook again, which is, you know, sure, folks are able to meet online, but they're not able to do it on their own terms.
Mm-hmm. We have a question here from Mark in Reading who dropped it off. He wants to know if you're talking about the internet in the historic sense or if you're talking about the World Wide Web.
So I do appreciate that question. I've certainly been using the terms interchangeably. I do spell out in the book that there's a difference between the internet and the web. So I would argue that I'm mostly right now talking about the web. But I also, in the book, talk a bit about the internet in terms of the infrastructure for getting online and how ISPs, or internet service providers, have become more commercialized over the past, say, 30 years. And for folks who don't know, the internet is sort of like the infrastructure that links one computer to another. So the internet is much older than the web. The internet was really made for devices to be able to talk to each other through phone lines that were in case with their own infrastructure, you didn't have to rely on the phone. The web is the content that we're actually sharing. So sometimes I think of it in terms of the internet is like a network of libraries that can share content with each other. And the books on the shelf, that's really much more what the web is, the content that you and I read.
Jeff Salingle's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Gentrification of the Internet, How to Reclaim Our Digital Freedom. So when we talk about the commercialization part of things where you know, the big five, Facebook, Apple, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft have essentially gotten huge shares of what's going on out there, I keep coming back to the concept of commons and enclosures. Did we essentially let big tech enclose parts of the net?
Because in the early days of most folks going online, we had these sort of what were called walled gardens, like AOL, which was sort of this sandbox where, you know, you would go online and be in this AOL constructed world. And of course, that was very corporate. But now that model has sort of been set aside of getting online, and now you have internet access and it unleashes you on the web as a whole. And then in terms of the closures, I just think more and more of our online lives are sort of being gobbled up by these larger platforms. So if you try to live your life without using the big five tech companies, it's not just inconvenient, it's really almost impossible. So they have that much of a hold over our online communities, our online expression, our online connectivity to one another. So they are sort of enclosing more and more of the internet, and it's getting harder and harder to really create a sense of connection or to have a community that thrives outside those major platforms.
You know, you asked this question of yourself, and it's an instructive one. Was the internet ever really ungentrified?
I think it's totally fair to ask that question, and I don't want to sound like I'm just nostalgic for the days of the internet in the 1990s. We certainly had things, you know, in the early days of the internet that were very problematic. Harassment, you know, Lisa Nakamura calls it identity tourism, or folks trying to claim the identities of other people. Lots and lots of commercialization. Ben Brunton has a wonderful book on the history of spam that talks about how spam was one of the first things to happen on the internet. So there are a lot of, you know, gross, annoying, bummer stuff that happened in the early days of the web. So was it ever totally ungentrified? No. I don't think any neighborhood is completely ungentrified where there's this, you know, purely authentic community that's never trying to remodel itself or serve attract a wealthier population. But really the question for me becomes, if you're a gentrifying neighborhood or if you're on a platform and you want to have a different vision of how the internet looks and feels, how much power do you have? And I think it's certainly true that over time, over the last, say, 25, 30 years, it's gotten harder and harder for ordinary internet users to exert a sense of, you know, control, to exert a sense of freedom, to have more privacy online. So whether or not the early internet was either ungentrified, I think it's pretty hard to argue that it hasn't gentrified more.
It's interesting to see the difference in perspectives, too, though, between those of us who've been using the internet for decades and people who haven't. And so you talk about how your students have different views of the net now from their predecessors 10 years ago.
Absolutely. So I first started teaching classes on digital culture in 2010. And at the time, you know, Facebook was in its heyday. The Arab Spring hadn't happened, but there was that same excitement over, you know, the possibilities of digital technology. And it was really my job at that time to teach students how the internet could have a dark side or a problematic side or the ways that it could disempower people. For the most part, my students walked in the door and they assumed the internet was for good. It was a democratic tool. It could help them personally and professionally. And I had to sort of help them see the ways that it could be a problem specifically for folks on the margins. And 10 years later, my students walk in with a totally different set of assumptions. They just assume the internet is problematic, that it is disempowering, that they have very little privacy. And they really can't imagine how anyone could ever have been excited about it. I mean, I had a conversation with a student in a classroom that in some ways really started the seed for this book, where she was, you know, we were reading early internet research, and she was like, I just can't understand why people thought that the internet could ever be pro-democracy, pro-social justice. And that really blew me away, because it's a very different idea of what the internet should be. So now I see my job as sort of helping students see that the internet we have wasn't inevitable and that it can be different. And in order to do that, we have to sort of think about these different moments where the internet sort of started transforming towards one set of priorities versus another.
Jessa Lingle teaches at the University of Pennsylvania Annenberg School of Communications. Her book is called The Gentrification of the Internet, How to Reclaim Our Digital Freedom. It's a conversation you're welcome to join. Share a story about the ways in which you've watched the web change over the years since you've been using it. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. I want to ask about some of the other social sites that were somewhat freer than Facebook, as they're mentioned here. Tumblr was way up and then way down. What happened to it?
Tumblr, to me, is a great example of a platform that has a really great story to tell about the internet. And so in the early days of Tumblr, it really was this sort of free-for-all, where it was an important site for doing, you know, lots of things. Like, one of my favorite accounts on Tumblr was an account that was just devoted to the staplers at a university library. So it just documented the lives of these different staplers from a university library. But it was also an incredibly important platform for, you know, queer folks, trans folks, and people who are interested in different kinds of BDSM or not safe for work content, so very adult content, sexually explicit content. And the platform really thrived. It really had its heyday in the sort of like late aughts to the early 2010s. And then the platform shifted ownership multiple times. So it was purchased by Yahoo, and then it was sold. And when it was purchased by Yahoo, it was incredibly expensive. And then they sold it a few years later for a fraction of its cost. And what had happened was that they kind of tried to gentrify the platform. They wanted to get away from this not safe for work content, and they wanted it to be, more like Pinterest, where, you know, you still wanted it to be young, still wanted it to be hip, but just wanted to strip out any of the seedier content or more objectionable content, depending on how prudish you were. And so what you saw was this massive, you know, exodus from the platform where folks said, well, I don't want to play by these new rules. I want to have a platform where I can, you know, be who I am, where I can express myself, where my content won't get censored if it's about sex or if it's about gender identity or things like that. And then you saw the platform's value really tumble. And so, so to speak.
I know. It's just funny that would happen to a place called Tumblr, but yeah, I hope you get the point.
I know. And the funny thing to me is that Tumblr users are very aware. So Tumblr users have this sort of spitefulness about the platform. So if you follow Tumblr at all, there's still a lot of gleefulness about how the platform's value has shrunk so much, and you don't really see that sort of gleefulness on other platforms. But what you see is what happens when someone comes in and says, I like this platform, I like the attention that it's getting, but I want to make it more suitable for the lowest common denominator of folks. I want it to be a little bit more generic. And what you see is an incredible devaluation of the platform.
So essentially, are people looking for private spaces or at least semi-private spaces where they can feel like they can be themselves a bit more? And I mean, talk about, for example, the body modification people, as you mentioned, piercing genitalia is not something Facebook's going to let you show.
It's not. And what happens is that more people are just forced to move to platforms where they have to play by somebody else's rules. So what you really see is on these smaller platforms where, you know, BME was really coded by community members and the rules were created by community members. And if you got kicked off the platform, there was a whole forum that was dedicated to explaining why people were forced to leave the platform, because that's what the community wanted. They wanted rules where there was a lot of visibility around people being forced to leave. And all of those things that really reflect the ethos of the community are not possible on a platform like Facebook, which, you know, has the unenviable task of trying to come up with, quote, community guidelines for a user population that's larger than the vast majority of, you know, countries, you know, that's larger than the population of Christians. So I'm not saying our job is easy, but I'm saying that the stakes of having a platform that has its own rules that don't reflect your community are much higher for folks who are on the margins in some way.
Some of the complaints, particularly the complaints of former Tumblr users, that they do sound a bit like Keep Portland or Keep Austin weird.
Absolutely. So it's people who have invested a lot of time and a lot of energy into a community. And so the Tumblr users who have spent hours and hours and hours crafting these online profiles, you know, gathering an archive of posts. And then suddenly a new rule comes in that says, well, you can't have that content. That content's no longer acceptable on our site. And people felt really betrayed because they felt like this was the platform where I didn't have to worry about that. This was the platform. I'm only here because I wanted to be able to share exactly this kind of stuff that you're now saying is okay. And it feels like it's going against the ethos of the site. And of course, both Portland and Austin, you know, the Keep Portland Weird, Keep Austin Weird, those are, you know, campaigns that are very much about gentrification, that are very much about who gets to decide what community looks like in this place, in this city. So there's definitely a battle to keep Tumblr weird. And I think that the stakes there for other tech companies, it's worth paying attention to what happens when you just decide to change the rules on a bunch of users who have put a lot of time and energy into that platform.
You know, the sort of, commodification, blandification, it's kind of like, you know, we went to this cool neighborhood burger joint and they all turned into McDonald's or something. Is that a decent parallel?
Absolutely. And I think what's important is not just about, well, now my hamburger options are worse. It's also about who gets to work there and what a living wage looks like. You know, that's when it comes to urban gentrification. And when it's been online platforms, it's about, but I spent a lot of time on this platform. I spent a lot of energy. That's where my community is. And I don't want to be forced to rebuild that somewhere elsewhere just okay. Because your idea of community doesn't look like mine.
You know, I'm coming back to what you said earlier, Jessa, when we were talking about the walled garden concept of America Online, when that was sort of like a lot of people's original ramp to the internet. And then after a while, they realized they didn't need the essentially the training wheels of AOL. and kind of moved away from it. In a sense, are we coming back to that kind of model where you just go to a couple of places that are slick and fun for you and you don't go anywhere else?
We are in many ways. So in a lot of places where Facebook has felt like they haven't made enough of a dent into the user population, you know, so they always talk about the next billion. Who else can we get to go online? There's something called Facebook Zero, which basically you can get online, so to speak, but really you can only get on Facebook, and you can sort of, it becomes this walled garden of Facebook. So for a lot of folks in the global south who are eager to get online, they're eager to get online to, you know, make friends online, to do business online. You know, there's lots of advantages to Facebook offering this plan for folks who don't have a data plan on their phones. But the drawback is it's that same walled garden model where you think that the internet is actually Facebook because your only experience of being online is through the lens of this platform. And we, in the 1990s, we pushed back on stuff like that, right? We said Microsoft couldn't, you know, default to their browser online. Mm-hmm. You know, we had this idea that people should have more choices in their online content. But these companies find a way to sort of, you know, steer you or direct you to their own platforms rather than having a broader experience of online life.
Do you see the big five we mentioned, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, as being involved in both online gentrification and in real life?
Yeah, so for folks who just think I'm stretching the metaphor too far, there is a very direct link to gentrification from these tech companies, and certainly you see that in places like Seattle, in places like San Francisco, San Jose, but many other tech hubs around the world, where these companies set up their headquarters and they become this massive infusion of money and tech employees that create these massive disparities for longstanding communities. So San Francisco is probably the most extreme example where the city has just really changed its character in a lot of ways because tech sector employees who want to live in an urban setting, they don't want to live in the South Bay, they want all the amenities of urban life and are willing to pay for it. So they've displaced a lot of long-term residents. They've created this sort of skyrocketing rent, which makes San Francisco's perennial problem with housing insecurity much, much worse. And so in that sense, there is a very direct link between tech companies and urban gentrification in terms of their tech workers taking over neighborhoods.
And as you point out, you grew up in the Bay Area, so so you can certainly relate to this directly. How different is the Bay Area you knew growing up from what you see when you go there now?
It's so different. I've been living out on the East Coast for about 16 years, but when I go home, I was just home a couple of weeks ago, I'm in my late 30s, so I hear my friends talk about a real estate market that just bears no relationship to anything that we have quite in Philadelphia. You know, just stories of people paying hundreds and thousands of dollars above asking price in cash for a house. And you can really tie that to the tech industry moving into San Francisco and then now taking over nearby cities like Oakland. So when I go to San Francisco now, it just doesn't bear any resemblance to the city that I remember, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. And that is a real loss. And you really can lay that at the feet of tech industries. So there's the famous case of, you know, Google having buses so that, you know, they could bus their workers from the city to San Francisco. So they don't even have to use public transit. They're just not putting in as much as they're taking out from the city.
So essentially the same people who changed the Bay Area changed the web. I mean, it's the same tech people.
It is, but over time, the culture has really changed. So there was a real countercultural streak. Fred Turner at Stanford has written about this. In the early days of the tech industry, this sort of embrace of technology as something that was going to free us from homogenous culture. And then you see now that narrative is almost completely been set aside, and we're much more focused on how the tech industry can just be the source of tremendous wealth. So students no longer necessarily want to go into tech because they're still curious about technology and what it can do, but often because it's where the biggest paychecks are. And I certainly don't blame people for wanting to make a buck. I'm just noting that that change in the industry has trickled down to the rest of us in terms of the rules and the policies and even the design of platforms based on this shift in who's working in the tech industry.
There's a story in here about a particular person, basically a tech bro as a neighbor. Tell us the story of Justin Keller.
Right. So this was a guy who moved to San Francisco to work in big tech. And he wrote a letter to the mayor of San Francisco complaining about the poverty and the homelessness that he saw on his way to work. And he was just so grossed out that he had to pass by homeless people on his way to work. Just felt that, he shouldn't have to see that as a wealthy, successful person in the city that he claimed to love so much. And he, had this narrative of, I've worked really hard to get where I am, and if other folks haven't, reached my same level of success, then they must not have worked hard. And so that to me was just so illustrative of this attitude of what kind of community someone sees in the city where they live. So turns out you don't want to see a vibrant community where different socioeconomic groups are represented, where different ideas are exchanged, or where you just simply have to see people living lives different from yours, but rather you just want a playground for other rich people like you. And that's the stakes of gentrification, is who gets to live and thrive here and who is an inconvenience to the people with the most money.
So let's think about that concept, though, the idea of gentrification as progress. I mean, by another name in the 1960s, this was urban renewal, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So you'll still see there are many folks who see gentrification, hear the word gentrification and think of it as a good thing. And those are usually folks who are making arguments in an economic sense. Like, this is going to bring more money into a neighborhood. It's going to bring more resources. It is undeniably true that most neighborhoods that are gentrifying have been, underinvested in. But if the people who are asking for resources don't get any say in how those resources are brought in, then you're always going to see this power imbalance. So in my neighborhood in South Philadelphia, long-term residents, are very aware of white folks like myself moving into the neighborhood. And their solution is they don't look at that and say, like, oh, wow, it's great that we have more resources now. They say, wow, these invaders are coming in, they disrespect our communities, and they don't listen to what we want. And so the word gentrification is loaded. Some people are like, why would you use such a loaded concept for a whole book? But to me, it's because the concept is so loaded that it becomes helpful for talking about the two sides of an issue that's as important as digital culture is.
Well, and to go back into the digital world, then, as you point out, some of the things that were found illegal in the real world have ended up showing up there as well, like redlining. What is digital redlining?
So digital redlining is when a platform like Facebook decides to show ads to one group or another based on where they live and their demographics. So if you've ever bought an ad on Facebook, you have a lot of choices about who can see that ad. And it's because Facebook's business model is to know as much as possible about each of its users so that it can target ads. So if you want to reach, 30-something vegans who are new parents, you can do that, right? They have that kind of granularity. Redlining back in the day, in the 1950s, was about realtors saying, we're not going to allow, home purchasing in certain neighborhoods, or we're going to charge more in those neighborhoods based solely on race and income. And the same thing was actually happening online, where different advertising about things like housing and realtors and about education were being, targeted away from people of color, people who are low income. So there was a 2017 housing HUD investigation on Facebook about the reproduction of redlining in this digital environment. So that's another very direct link between gentrification online and offline.
And the original redlining was don't rent to African Americans, or actually don't give loans to African Americans who want to move into these areas beyond these red lines.
Absolutely. So it was saying you can't live here, you can't buy a house here, you can't rent here, simply because we think, you know, because we're racist and we don't want people like you living in our neighborhood. And the online version is we don't want people like you seeing these ads. They're not for you, which is a deeply unequal, a very problematic way of showing ads. But it's the natural extension of the business model. I mean, Facebook's business model is based on showing ads to a very targeted group of people. So if anything, it would be surprising if that hadn't happened, given Facebook's business model.
Which comes back to one of the original basic root complaints you have about digital gentrification is isolation. That I mean, social media and its algorithms get the blame, but the fact is that these algorithms are designed by people.
Absolutely. And they're designed by people, so they reflect human bias, but they're also meant to keep you on a platform for as long as possible. So mainstream platforms have a business model of attention, trying to keep you engaged on a platform for as long as possible. And they know psychologically the best way to do that is to show you the same content over and over and over again. So if you were an anti-vaxxer and you watch an anti-vaxxing YouTube video, the next video that comes up in your loop is going to be another anti-vaxxer video rather than one that says, now here's the other side of that debate. Because they know that that kind of rabbit hole is the best way to keep someone online. And platforms are dealing with ways to manage that. But until then, what we're seeing is a lot of isolation where you're sort of in this niche where you only see the same viewpoint over and over and over again. And one of the biggest problems with that, or the main disappointments for me, is that one of the things that was supposed to be an advantage of the internet was breaking down some of the IRL isolation that we have. In general, humans aren't usually that great about diversifying our social networks. We tend to end up with a friend group, with a professional group, certainly with a church group who is the same demographics that we are. And online, that was, in the early days, one of the great things was exposing you to new viewpoints or different perspectives, people from different backgrounds. But increasingly, online platforms are much more interested in shoveling you into a group of people who express the same views and have the same interests that you do.
So, Jessa, with the minute plus we have left, I mean, what kinds of ideas for not being used by the platforms, other than going maybe Facebook zero for a while? I mean, what kinds of things can we do to resist gentrification on the web?
There's a few things you can do. And in the end of the book, I have a whole list of resources for folks. But I would say the main things are learning about the policies of your platforms, going out of your way to diversify your online network. So following people that you haven't normally followed, following groups of people who are totally outside your sphere of familiarity, different places, different ages, different backgrounds, different races. And also just when it comes to ISPs, just like really learning about what are the ISPs in my neighborhood and what are my local policymakers rules and what are their voting habits when it comes to things like, net neutrality and service provision of utilities. So these are all steps that we can take to be more literate about our online platforms and also to sort of push back on the algorithms that are shoveling us into more isolated, more commercialized spaces.
Let me remind listeners, when we say IRL, we do mean in real life, so as opposed to online life. So that is the story from Jessa Lingle at the University of Pennsylvania. Her book is The Gentrification of the Internet, How to Reclaim Our Digital Freedom. Jessa, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.